This is the Popmatic Podcast for January 13th, 2016. Yeehaw!
Let's ride.
Nothing?
I don't know. I can't beat that.
I don't know.
I want to
ride it. Get along. I want to
get a doggy.
Get a rope.
Get along.
Is the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are...
Amanda.
Wild Bill.
Sheriff Mac.
Sheriff Mac.
And there's someone isn't here who apparently got tired of us abusing him.
He's wrestling some
cattle. There's no Western comic books to talk about, so...
He's heading him off at the pass.
He's been in the saddle too long.
Yeah.
His frosting's wild.
He's got some Wild West chafing.
I hate when that happens.
We have a love-hate relationship with chafing on the Popmatic Podcast. We also have a love-hate relationship with Quentin Tarantino here at Popmatic. But a new Tarantino movie is always an event. So in honor of the Hateful Eight, today's show is all about Westerns. Get 'em up, get 'em up. Bill.
Yes.
What's happening in your neck of the Old West?
Well, I'm going to talk about the final movie that George Pal directed. Now, for those of you not in the know, George Pal directed Tom Thumb, The Time Machine, Atlantis, The Lost Continent, all fantasy films. So you're probably wondering how this fit in. Well, the last film he directed was a movie called The Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe. It's an offbeat Western in which a mysterious circus comes to a Western town that both entertains the town folk but also teaches them valuable life lessons.
What is the eerie secret behind the seven faces of Dr. Lowe? Do they come from another world, or are they just one mysterious being? When more unusual pictures are made, you may be sure George Pal will make them. His War of the Worlds, Time Machine, and Destination Moon are now joined by the strange and fascinating adventures of Dr. Lowe and his amazing companions.
You wish your future told?
How do you do? The name is Merlin. I am the greatest magician the world has ever known.
Hi there. Do I look familiar to you?
What in the world is a Medusa?
A Medusa, dear heart, is a creature with snakes on her head. And if you look at her face, you turn to stone.
I'll show her!
What kind of Oriental hocus pocus is going on around here?
I, sir, am a major mystery.
Out of nowhere he came. A mysterious stranger. And for those he opposed or defended, life was never again the same.
This town ain't big enough for you and me, partner.
A magician, surely, but one who made his magic with such things as love's young dream and the fun in a little boy's heart. Here truly is entertainment for all ages.
I was born in the year 1204.
I am 7,322 years old.
I'm 8 going on 9.
Here is the mysterious beauty of the Far East and the roaring action of the Far West. The thrilled spectacle of the city that never was and the most fabulous fish story in history.
A genuine bona fide sea serpent. In the water, he is small, insignificant, petite. But out of the water, and he doubles his size every 10 seconds until he reaches his full growth.
Just imagine a sea monster who can't stand the water. How about that?
Oh, I got him! Oh, I got him!
That's showbiz!
Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe was based on a novel by Charles G. Finney. And the script was written by Charles Beaumont, who wrote many of the memorable Twilight Zone episodes.
I may have mentioned that.
William Tunnell won an honorary Oscar for his makeup for Dr. Lowe, and Mr. Tunnell also worked on The Twilight Zone. Also, it was nominated for Best Visual Effects, but lost to that stupid Mary Poppins.
Like Mary Poppins.
That's stupid Mary Poppins.
Spoonful of sugar.
So do you need a spoonful of sugar?
Yeah. It's not supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
The best thing about Dr. Lowe, or the best effect, is the actor they hired to play Dr. Lowe. At first, the director wanted Peter Sellers, which would be a natural choice because of Strange Love. And he was interested in doing it, but the studio wanted him to pick Tony Randall. And Tony Randall, best known for his comedic work. Well, Tony Randall's a classically trained actor. People don't realize that sometimes. And he was more than up for the challenge because not only does Tony Randall play Dr. Lowe, but he plays Merlin the Magician, Pan the God of Love, the Serpent, Medusa, and the Blind Fortune Teller. He is also credited as playing the Abominable Snowman in the movie, but in doing research, I found that the role was played by the son of George Pyle. So, Dr. Lowe is a one-of-a-kind movie that deserves to be seen. It's rare to see a movie with two different genres, Western and fantasy, meld so brilliantly together. Mike?
Wow. Yeah, I remember the final episode of Joel Hodgson on Mystery Science Theater 3000 had a very long quote from Dr. Lowe.
Yes.
Because it was his favorite movie, apparently. Uh-huh. So I had to track it down. Good stuff. So, this week's episode, this is devoted, belatedly dedicated to the release of The Hateful Eight, which I saw on New Year's Eve. The 70mm Roadshow edition is very fun. You get a program, there's an intermission, it's like 20 minutes longer, but you don't mind because it's an intermission.
I didn't get a program. And I went
you didn't get a program?
It must have been out.
It must have run out. Yeah, it's a cool program. Maybe I'll bring it over.
Yeah, do, please.
Yeah, it was kind of neat flipping through it. It had like the history of Ultra Panavision and like the last movie in Ultra Panavision was...
Cool.
Cartoon. In 1966.
Interesting.
Good stuff. I loved it. I thought it was a close number two to Kill Bill Volume 1. Although I can see why it's not a lot of people's cup of tea. Since none of the characters are particularly likable, most of them are downright cruel and mean. And the film is like 90% dialogue, and a lot of it is racial slurs and bigotry. But for me, it was a great throwback to the spaghetti western. Most of them were filled with cruel men either chatting endlessly or committing heinous violence. Oh boy. My favorite kind of protagonist was the man with no name style bounty killer, where the only difference between the good guys and the bad guys is that the good guys might do something good if there's any profit in it. Speaking of Eastwood films, I thought that today I would recommend a movie that itself was an American version of a spaghetti western, High Plains Drifter, from 1973. Directed by Eastwood himself and written by Shaft creator Ernest Tiedemann. Eastwood plays a mysterious man known only as The Stranger, who drifts into a town called Lago. Lago has a problem. Some criminals who have beef with the entire town have been released from prison and are riding post-haste to Lago to have their revenge. The mayor, along with a cabal of local businessmen, decide to hire the stranger to save the town. They declare him sheriff and, much to their eventual sorrow, allow him to do whatever he likes.
A drifter came riding out of the west. You know him as Clint Eastwood. The citizens of Lago didn't know him at all.
What did you say your name was again?
I didn't.
Fear was in their greeting. Murder was in their minds.
We were talking about hiring a gunfighter.
Yeah, we don't know anything about that fellow there. Well, who is he? Where's he come from?
You don't want to get shot. You don't want your shops or your houses burned. You don't want your women touched. You don't want anything to happen. Except you're afraid to do anything about it.
That stranger's got everybody in this town at each other's throats.
One man against one town. Not bad odds.
About time this town has a new sheriff.
I'm the sheriff.
And the mayor.
The mayor.
Any objections?
No. You shot my ear off! I'll kill every man in Lago!
You know what you are. You're an animal.
Well, you have a way of bringing that out.
They didn't know him when he drifted into town. Now they'll never forget him.
Who are you?
You see, the stranger looks a lot like a man named Joe Duncan, the former sheriff who was whipped to death in the middle of the town by the very same outlaws who had just been released. And none of the townsfolk lifted a finger to save him. He's already treating these townsfolk like dumb hillbillies who can't defend themselves, but now the stranger really begins to let loose with his rage and disgust at, you know, the people who he's just, you know, the... Also, you know, a brief tangent. I don't really want to go into trigger warning style specifics, but the stranger does something very vile and horrifying near the beginning of the film. I've heard some interesting interpretations of this act, but to me it just makes him less of a good guy hero and more of like a living personification of vengeance who doesn't really care what anybody else thinks. In researching this, I found in Wikipedia that John Wayne was so disgusted by High Plains Drifter that he sent a letter to Eastwood saying that, quote, "This isn't what the West is all about. That isn't the American people who settled this country," unquote. So if John Wayne hates it, I recommend. For me, at least, I find movies like this and Hateful Eight far more interesting than, you know, your white hat, black hat style theatrics. I'm a huge Eastwood fan, and this is my favorite of his non-dollars westerns. And you can stay tuned later, gang, for the Tickle My Fancy segment, where I praise the work of another elderly man, old enough to be my grandfather. What do you have, Amanda?
Well, unlike everyone else here, I've never really been a big fan of the serious western. I know you're all shocked by that. My dad used to watch them all the time on TV. John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, blah, blah, blah. don't care. And I'm pondering,
I'll take my spurs elsewhere.
I know. And I'm pondering why this is. I think it's because these are, finger quotes, boy movies. Like, usually the women portrayed are some kind of ladies of ill repute. Like, there's not. I mean, every now and again, you'll get a sassy frontier chick.
I mentioned I like Eastwood near any lady, and they just, like, you know.
Like, oh, she's a whore. Yay.
Watch Johnny Guitar.
Oh, yeah, good stuff.
Okay, but luckily, some other filmmakers agreed with me, and they took the standard spaghetti western that Mike mentioned, and they added humor, starting with Blazing Saddles from Mel Brooks in 1974 and continuing with Jackie Chan classic Shanghai Noon, or even Mel Gibson in the remake of Maverick. I enjoy a good, funny western. And recently I came across another film to add to that canon. Family Guy funny man Seth MacFarlane decided to tackle the western genre with his 2014 film A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Oh, hey, look, it's the ice. Why is it so big?
So it doesn't melt. It's actually really interesting how they do it. It's this one company out in Boston that...
Ah! Ah! That went south so fast! Ah!
The American West is a terrible place in time. Everything out here that's not you wants to kill you. Angry drunk people. Hungry animals. Outlaws. Oh, the doctor.
I couldn't save her.
She had a splinter.
Doc,
what the hell were you supposed to do?
I would like to welcome a new member to our community.
Welcome to our awesome town.
What's with this fair?
Every year, people die.
Really?
Everybody hold still.
People die at the fair.
People die at the fair.
Somebody in this town is going to die.
Please don't shoot us on sex night.
You beat this guy at a gunfight, you're going to be a real hero.
He's the most vicious gunfighter in the territory.
I'm going to teach you how to shoot.
I got to get a running start.
Dude, you really shouldn't drink it, horse.
Aim up.
Get ready. I'm about to shoot a full load at your cans.
Shut up.
Just keep going. Hey.
Idea. You've never seen one?
No, I feel like I should have a piece of cake or something.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
I know you're here, Stark. Nakla, henaza imeko.
Ahahatena ashte. Mila kunis, mila kunis.
Tai George,
neglect.
Cha cha, Tanjo.
Shite. Tashi go ute.
Wow, you look amazing.
I really love that the most alluring fashion today is to simulate a fat ass.
If I was a black guy, this is the meanest trick you could play on me.
A million ways to die in the West.
Maybe the frontier is not so bad after all.
Hey, it's a sweet young couple. Can I interest you folks in a miracle cure?
Holy
I think I've mentioned it, like, on Tickle My Fancy segment right when I first saw it, because I thought it was hilarious. And I watched it again the other night just to see if it really was as funny as I remembered it being. And I am happy to report that it was. I laughed as hard the first time, maybe more because I think I caught some things I missed the first time, like you do. Basic premise, Sheep Herder Albert, played by McFarlane, gets dumped by his prissy Amanda Seyfried girlfriend for a mustachioed Neil Patrick Harris. After briefly, it's a tough one. So after briefly considering suicide, Albert decides to challenge NPH to a duel to win back his lady love. Unfortunately, he can't shoot. But luckily for him, Charlize Theron shows up to help him. Albert really likes her, but she neglects to tell him that she's married to Liam Neeson, who plays Clinch, the deadliest gun in the West. As you can imagine, hijinks ensue. Come for the Seth MacFarlane irreverence, stay for Giovanni Ribisi and Sarah Silverman's horror with the heart of gold. It's shocking, it's funny, it's just like Family Guy, but set with real people in the Old West. I thought it was highly enjoyable, but beware, people die at the fair.
Is it like Family Guy in that there's like weird like cutaways to like fast flashbacks and then cuts back?
There's a lot of
there are big side. Fancy production numbers too.
Yeah, there's like a random joke and then they go back to the
cutaway flashback to a joke and then cut back forward.
It's not quite as jumpy as Family Guy is, but it's exactly like Family Guy. It's just set in the West with people and sheep.
So I got to ask you, too, last week when you weren't here, there was some debate as to whether you were a Quentin Tarantino fan.
I can't say that I'm a fan. He's a little bit violent for me, but I have watched. I mean, I appreciate his movies for what they are, but like all of, like the Grindhouse stuff that he did, like I don't like that. Yeah. Like I'm more like the Kill Bill and Pulp Fiction.
Yeah,
color me shocked.
I know.
I just assumed that Amanda would just be like, nope. Super violent.
I think he's a pretty good storyteller. He just goes a long way around the bloody route to get there.
So those of you who have seen The Hateful Eight, one of the thoughts I did have is like, if you're going to do a movie where it's like seven people in a cabin, why shoot it on 70 millimeter?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that too. I mean, when they went outside and there was like the big snowscapes and, you know, the thrilling Ennio Morricone score and stuff, it was like, yeah. And then they spend most of it inside a cabin and it's like, I didn't really get why this had to be in 70 millimeter. It was pretty though.
Paul Thomas Anderson shot The Master in 70 millimeter too, didn't he?
Paul Thomas Anderson actually shot The Master in 65 millimeter, and those 5 millimeters make all the difference.
And that's mostly just people talking. And I love that movie, so it's all good. I guess this is kind of a dark episode. This is kind of like dark westerns. Uh-huh. Dark westerns, I'll just keep it going.
Just punch Mike or shoot Mike, and then the blood will fly, and then it'll be very Tarantino.
Why?
So there were two movies that kept popping into my head that I maybe wanted to talk about today. That was The Hired Hand and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. I didn't know if I wanted to go there as both are 70s auteur deconstructed anti-Westerns, you know. Maybe that's not in the spirit of the episode. But my hand was forced when the cinematographer for both films, Vilo Zsigmond, passed away last week. So if I had to pick one film to talk about, I'll pick McCabe and Mrs. Miller, who I don't think I've mentioned too much on the podcast before. But if I was asked to reel off like a list of my favorite films, McCabe and Mrs. Miller would be right at the top of the list. So Warren Beatty plays McCabe, who comes to a cold, wet hellhole of a town in rural Washington called Presbyterian Church. He sees the town as an easy mark where he can set up a saloon and a whorehouse and, you know, be the big guy in the small town. But wait! He doesn't know the first thing about running a whorehouse, believe it or not. Enter Mrs. Miller, played brilliantly by Julie Christie, who is an uppercut of a woman that does know how to run a whorehouse. McCabe is used to being the big man in town until he meets Mrs. Miller. Will Mrs. Miller steal his money and his heart? They strike up a deal where Mrs. Miller takes care of the ladies and McCabe takes care of the whiskey and the gambling. Everything is dandy until the big mining company comes and wants to buy out not only his saloon, but the entire town. McCabe holds out against faceless corporate greed, but there ain't no God and there ain't no law in this version of the Old West. I won't spoil anything, but McCabe is an anti-hero, and Beatty's performance so undercuts male stereotypes that John Wayne winces in his grave every time he hears those opening guitar notes of Leonard Cohen's The Stranger Song, which plays over the credits.
It's true that all the men you knew were dealers who said they were through with dealing every time you gave them shelter. I know that kind of man. It's hard to hold the hand of anyone who's reaching for the sky just to surrender. Who is reaching for the sky just to surrender. And then sweeping up the jokers that he left behind, you find he did not leave you very much, not even laughter. Like any dealer, he was watching.
I love that song. See, normally I hate a guy on the guitar. That one, maybe they made a guy on the guitar. It's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. The score is by Leonard Cohen. Did I mention that? The director is some old dead white guy that made a movie about Nashville. But just like that movie, the town and the look and feel of Presbyterian Church is just as much a character as any of the actors. It's set in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, it feels like a Western, even though it's set in, like, 19th century Washington. It begins in the fall. It's all yellows and oranges. It's always sunset. When it's not, everything is lit by candles and gas lamps. And if that isn't, if they didn't use, like, natural light, it looks like it was. So it's kind of amazing. It's all wood and pine trees. It's like Eat Your Heart Out, Twin Peaks, even though the tone is very different. But that look where like everything is made out of like wood and like browns and oranges. Not to mention at the end, all of these sort of rich palette of colors is sort of voided by snow and ice. It's all shot by Vilmos Zsigmond, a gosh darn masterpiece. I love this movie. It is beautiful and subtle, and I highly recommend it. McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Well.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, Brian.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Come up with a new slogan.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have to do the creepy whisper. We can do, hey, guys, what do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, Brian.
Maybe the liar has it, but either way, it's taking my fancy.
All right.
All right, then I get all heavy. Oh.
Bring us down, Mike.
That's
Bring us
right.
down.
Frowny face. So I was amused, I guess, because the night that Lemmy died, I was thinking, gee, 2015 has been quite possibly the best year ever. Everything was coming up, Mike. And then I check a Facebook and, oh.
That's your Motorhead guy, right?
Yeah, the lead singer of Motorhead
passed away.
December 26th. He wasn't feeling well. It was one of those, like, you know, his birthday was like the 24th. And then 2 days later, he goes to the doctor and is like, you are really, really sick. And then 2 days later, he's dead. So I was like, ah. So I can't really, I mean, I don't really mourn somebody I don't really know, but I'm still pretty crushed. And I still kind of am, frowny face. So I thought for this tickler, I'd briefly mention two things. And by briefly, I mean the biggest paragraph ever. So I've listened to most of Motorhead, and I think the few albums I haven't listened to, I'll save for later. Because, you know, with things I love, I find it hard to finish them. Hence me never seeing the last few episodes of Firefly. Really, the last Parker and Flashman novels are still taking on my bookshelf, et cetera, et cetera. Instead, this week I started listening to Hawkwind, the band that Lemmy was in before Motorhead. Yeah, fun fact, he found out that he was fired when his bandmates went to their next gig without him in the middle of the night. He woke up in north of England, going like, well, where'd everybody go? And he had to, like, hitchhike back to London. My buddy Graham tried really hard to get me into them, like, 12 years ago, but I was like, they fired Lemmy? Who fires Lemmy? That's like if, you know, Happy Days had fired the Fonz.
Hey.
So it turns out that Hawkwind is like Mike Catnip. Why, it's all new wave science fiction references. Like half the songs on one of the albums is like Norman Spinrad novels. I'm like, hey, I know Norman Spinrad. This is amazing. And it's all groovy 70s hard and prog rock. Oh, man. Apparently they're technically space rock, which is even cooler. They even have a Blue Oyster Cult connection with their freaking collabos with Michael Moorcock. Anywho, I thought I would recommend one of the few tracks that Lemmy sang on. from the album In the Hall of the Mountain Grill, which is on Hoopla. It's called Lost Johnny. A lot better than the other song you sang on Silver Machine, which somehow is their best song, and I don't see it. Lastly, briefly, I thought I'd say to you, the listener, hey, if there's something you've put off doing for years, may have excuses, you may be scared of change or doing something big or whatever, you should just go ahead and try it. Why? I always wanted to see Motorhead live, but they're a few states away, and it costs money, and concerts suck, and the last year I saved up cash and went on a solo vacation and had a wonderful time. So I thought I'd just like, and I got to see my favorite live band live. I will be their last tour. So, seize the day, gang. Carpe Yodo.
All right. Yeah, I was going to say, you got to see Lemmy play like one of his last shows.
Yeah, we got him.
I'm still sticking to the Western theme here.
Oh, yeah.
So, tickling my fancy.
Lemmy was fond of cowboy hats.
Tickling my fancy is a DVD we have, and I was very grateful, called No Name on the Bullet.
John Gant.
If Gant stays here, somebody's gonna die.
23 times John Gant had dueled with death and won. Always legally, always fairly.
Why didn't you kill me?
I wasn't paid to.
Now he was on his 24th mission. But nobody knew the name on his bullet. And every man with a guilty secret was sure it was his.
Why do I have to go?
You want to stay alive, don't you?
No Name on the Bullet. Starring Audie Murphy in the most unusual role of his exciting career. Lovely Joan Evans, who walked straight into trouble.
He told Luke that that was the only way to stop you. Kill him and you hang.
And Charles Drake as the courageous doctor.
He's dead. I couldn't stop it. You were expecting it to happen, weren't you?
I wasn't surprised.
You killed him.
And it's Luke. What happened?
I'm all right. Where's Dad? He's gone after Dad.
Take it easy. Take it easy.
No, it's true. He admitted it. Please, Luke, you've got to stop him. Please.
Gant, I've come to ask you to leave.
And if I don't?
Directed by Jack Arnold, who's best known for his science fiction movies, The Creature from the Black Lagoon and The Incredible Shrinking Man. Now, this is going to be a very short tickle my fancy because I'm not going to give any spoilers, but when I saw The Hateful Eight, there's a scene in this movie between Samuel L. Jackson and Bruce Dern's characters. I won't give it away, but I'm sure it's the inspiration from No Name on the Bullet starring Audie Murphy. So I'm just going to simply say, I highly recommend No Name on the Bullet, directed by Jack Arnold, starring Audie Murphy. And the nice thing about it, it's just 70 minutes long.
So it's win-win-win.
A B movie that rises above its...
Yeah.
It's also interesting to note it's written by Gene L. Coon, who had a lot to do with the original Star Trek television show. He created the Klingons and stuff. So it has this science fiction background, but it's a great Western. Many of the tributes to Westerns I saw in Quentin Tarantino's
The
Hateful Eight.
A lot of, with Django, I saw a lot of spaghetti Western references, and even the original Django popped in. But this one I couldn't really, see as many.
Well, first of all, it's got Reservoir Dogs. you know, yeah. isolated. And then you've got The Great Silence, which is a spaghetti yeah. western with the snow.
Yeah.
Then there's Rio Bravo when she plays the guitar.
In I it. See that.
And then at the very end, it's John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah, I heard that he used an unused track from The Thing, which is just amazing.
At the end. But yeah. even the setup with the actors, that's out of the thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's true. I was sitting there thinking, true. And then when I watched the credits, there it is. He uses Morricone's. Man. And that's something we need to mention. The one thing I really loved about it was Morricone's score.
The soundtrack is amazing. I went out and bought it with Human Money. It's in my car right now.
As opposed to Alien Money?
Downloading it.
Oh, as opposed to stealing it.
Stealing it. That's right. I gave them money because it's so good.
Well, Django Unchained, I remember there's one place in that movie he uses, I Got a Name by Jim Croce, and it's just so out of place, I thought, for the movie. This one, he has a consistent score. And yeah. That was one of the things I really liked about the movie.
Well, Morricone is one of the best film composers of all time ever. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to stick with Westerns, too, for it tickle my fancy. And I recently watched that new Adam Sandler movie, The Ridiculous Six, which is only available right now on Netflix. And I tried to find out if this was, like, because Tarantino's The Hateful Eight, this is, like, his spoof of that, The Ridiculous Six, but I don't think they're related. Seven. I think it just kind of came out at the
Cutthroat's
same time.
Nine.
What's this now?
You're an orphan! Raised by Indians!
I'm fixing to rob the bank here in town.
What are you?
His name is White Knife.
That's right!
Yeah! I swear a man can't ride 5 miles in this territory without running into outlaws and Indians. Apparently, there's some new gang out there robbing everybody blind.
Half the lawmen in the West are already looking for us.
You know which way them there Ridiculous Six rode off to?
This is gonna be so much fun.
No.
If Frank Stockburn is your father, raise your hand.
Huh? Oh, dang.
Let's saddle up. Burning daylight.
Who are you people?
We are the Starkburn brothers.
Don't forget about numero seis!
How would you men like to participate in the birth of something extraordinary?
You brothers ready to go save Dad?
Daddy!
Works better if you have knives. I'm ready.
I'm hungry.
I'm drunk.
I'm loopy.
It's your day.
Well, we're unstoppable then.
I like that.
I can't wait.
People gonna lose their shit.
So, it's everything you'd expect from an Adam Sandler movie. But I thought it was the funniest because of the casting. Like, everybody and their brother is in this. Sandler plays a guy whose mother was killed in front of him in the Old West. And so then he gets adopted and raised by Indians because his father had abandoned them. Said father comes back. He's, of course, dying and is sick, and he wants to make amends. But then he's kidnapped by his old gang, so Sandler sets off to dig up enough ransom money to save him. Now, along the way, he stumbles across 5 previously unknown brothers. Dad was, a bit of a rogue. And the brothers are played by Rob Schneider, naturally, Jorge Garcia from Lost, Terry Crews, Luke Wilson, and Taylor Lautner. And they need to steal $50,000 to save dear old dad. And I'm not going to, kind of like Bill, I'm not going to give too much more away, or Harvey Keitel might just lose his head. Also, please enjoy the cameo of Vanilla Ice as Mark Twain, which I never thought I would say in my life.
What?
It's hilarious. Oh. I mean, it's funny. As you could expect, this has been panned by critics. I think it currently has a 0 rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
It's got a 5 on IMDb, apparently.
Yeah, but I thought it was hilarious. It didn't change my life, but it was a good way to spend a couple hours. Brian?
I would be remiss if I didn't mention that during the shooting of this movie, some Native American actors and the film's cultural advisor quit the movie in protest. They found the script offensive and were ignored when they pointed out the costumes were not correct. Sandler's response was that it was a misunderstanding and that no one would be offended by the finished movie. Netflix's response was that the film was obviously an over-the-top farce and should be considered as such. I'll put a link to an article about this, but if you want to go a little deeper on how Native people are portrayed in movies, I recommend the documentary Real Engine. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff about Westerns in there. You should check it out.
And now for something completely different. So tickling my fancy is Sandman Overture.
Well, I'm reading that right now. I'm like halfway through it.
By Neil Gaiman.
What a quinky dink.
J.H. Williams III and Dave Stewart. Not that Dave Stewart. So Sandman is the Lord of Dreams, but he has a problem. A star has gone insane and wants to prematurely spoil the universe. Oh, the crap you have to deal with when you are the Lord of Dreams. I play curmudgeon on this show a lot, but if I'm being honest, Neil Gaiman has had a huge influence on my life. Would I be a librarian were it not for Neil Gaiman? I don't know. But I fell in love with Neil Gaiman and his work on The Sandman, which ran for 75 issues in the magical 1990s.
Yeah.
Lord of Goth Dreams goes all mythic tilt-a-wheel. Yeah, you get it. Okay. So then Neil Gaiman became this superstar, world-famous novelist, and I had to just shrug my shoulders a bit. All the stuff in the novels was stuff that he had already written in The Sandman. So I tried to go back and read The Sandman again, not Overture, but the original series, and, you know, it's not that it was bad, but I just kind of felt like I'd been there, done that. So it was with a certain degree of cynicism that I started Sandman Overture. My cynicism has been annihilated. All over art by J.H. Williams III and colors by Dave Stewart. Sandman Overture is like a toilet plunger to your amygdala.
It's pretty trippy. I'm not 100% certain I'm understanding everything that's going on. but, you know, it's the structure of dreams.
Of dreams, and phantasmagoria abounds. It is narratively difficult. You know, it's like, what's actually, you won't know what's really happening.
Yeah.
So is the original Sandman like that too, or this is just kind of a new level of Sandman?
Storylines were, you know, some of them were pretty straightforward, and other ones were kind of this weird dreamscape where you're like trying to, you know. Mm-hmm. So I could see where it's not completely unknown, I guess.
Most comic books are kind of like the X-Files, in that there were Monster of the Week episodes, and then also the big overarching, like, big story. Mm-hmm. And Sandman, even though it was, like, you know, marketed as, like, arty or something, was the same way.
Same way.
Yeah. So Williams' art for this book is perfect. And
it is beautiful.
I want J.H. Williams to go back and redo the Sandman with his art. Because, like, not that the other art was bad, but, like...
Wasn't it a different artist every issue or something? Something
it was, like
that?
Or there were
every storyline, maybe? Because it mean, was... Some of them, yeah, were way better than others.
Yeah, just like in, you know, other, like, comic books that were getting published monthly, it was kind of like our podcast. You know, the barrel rolls down the hill, and some days you got to make do, right? You know how it is in comics publishing? Like, someone's always busy or something happens, but you got a deadline. So yeah, there were different artists on Sandman. But with this one, I know, I've heard Gaiman say in interviews that, you know, basically because he's famous now, there was like, we had no deadline. We took as much time as we wanted. The version that the library has is like glossy pages, which I don't like glossy pages, but this is one of the few comics where it was like, oh, digital colors, glossy pages, I get it. I totally understand that there's potential that you can't get with old-fashioned printing. But you can with digital coloring and glossy pages. It's just like, you just could not get that effect. It's like really like big format, you know, like, I don't know what's the size of the, I'm supposed to be a book person. It's not normal comic book size. They're like bigger pages. It's hardback and it's amazing. It will melt your brain. Sandman Overture by Neil Gaiman, J.H. Williams, and Dave Stewart. And no, you did not need to read the original Sandman to get it. You can
just read kind my of mind. I was going
to
ask that.
According to Goodreads, this is number zero of the Sandman series. So technically, you could start here if you wanted to.
Corrections! Do you guys have any corrections about our January 6th episode?
No.
Sorry I made fun of hippies. Gluten-free stuff is great.
Back on the June 24th, 2015 episode, I said that Steve Inkeep's Jackson Land utilized prosopography. That wasn't really true. I was kind of abusing that word, just so you guys know. But for more information...
So you saved that for like 6 months?
You used a big word without knowing what it meant?
I abused it. You know how like a politician will like use a word with multiple meanings?
Uh-huh.
You know, and kind
Okay. Meaning, I don't know what the meaning is.
So it's kind of a... kind of like that. So Jackson Land is kind of a comparative biography of Andrew Jackson and John Ross.
Right.
And prosopography is like you have a bunch of historical evidence about people, but not specific people.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
So actually, okay, thanks. I used it wrong, okay?
We never use anything wrong.
Stretching the meaning. Wink.
I used prosopography wrong in June 24th, 2015 episode. For more information about prosopography and other nonfiction books.
In next January.
You can get other exciting nonfiction books at the library. Our website is
www.library.nashville.org.
Org. Our theme music is by
Adam Dane.
Pop quiz next week is
In space. No one aliens. Can hear you scream.
Aliens. Favorite Robert Altman movie?
I haven't watched any Robert Altman movies.
You never even watched Nashville?
No, that's the one I need to watch, but...
Well,
seriously.
Yeah, you may like that one.
I feel like, because that was like in the 70s, and like I watched The Dukes of Hazzard growing up, so I feel like I've seen like all the panel
in a way, it's pretty neat, because you can see like Nashville like in the 70s, so it's all like, oh, look, it's the Parthenon with a bunch of like, you know, or oh, look, it's downtown.
Yeah, lower, it's got Demon's Den in it, which I still remember, and that's... And even Demon's in it. He's on the phone. He's the nightclub manager. And so, I mean, that's going back to when, you know, during that time when they filmed it, it was considered a slum. It's not what it
downtown
is like today.
Yeah, like Second Avenue.
Yeah, that's what I'd heard about.
And it was just kind of like peep shows and honky-tonk, real honky-tonk.
It looked a lot more interesting than downtown.
And the winner is...
Wilma Stigman for Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
I would like to thank you first to this country, the American people who gave me a second life. I would like to thank my old masters in the Hungarian Film School, Illés György, Bojkovszky Béla, and János Badal. Also, I would like to thank you, all of you. Pop, pop,